Thank you.
Representative Fox, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Minutes are adopted. We have one bill to be heard today. Representative Bill, welcome to committee on the other end there. Your House File, would you like to move your...
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1283, and that should be recommend to pass and sent to Environment Policy. Okay, and Madam Chair, the first item I'd like to take up is two oral amendments, so if the members could look on the line 11.13. Okay, on 11.13, I want to delete the word town or.
Representative Bill, could you just clarify, do you mean on the DE1 amendment or on the bill itself?
No, on the DE3 amendment.
DE3.
I'm sorry, yeah. I actually was moving the DE3. I'm sorry. The 1283 DE3 should be recommended to pass and referred to the Environment Policy, Madam Chair. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you, Representative Bill.
So okay. If you'll look on line 11.13, you'll see number 2, and we would eliminate, the amendment would eliminate town or. And for the Chair's edification, a town is a township. Okay, then I have an additional amendment, which you could find on line 14.22. And this is in the section that's relative to Representative Tao's bill. And it would be on line 14.22, after A, it should read 30-gallon or larger drum. DRUM, 30-gallon or larger drum. And you would strike the words 55-gallon metal container. Those are my two oral amendments, Madam Chair, at the moment.
Is there any discussion? I just had one question regarding the 30-gallon. We are not in any danger of bears running around with those on their heads, are we? I mean, by making that smaller than a 55?
Well, I'm going to have Mr. Meyer talk, Commissioner Meyer talk about that.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. That's one of the reasons why we want to clarify this language, to make sure that we are not creating those problems that are out there right now. Mr. Boggess and I sat down and looked at the definition that was there and looked at the diameters of these drums. 30-gallon drum, the diameter is roughly 19 1/4 inches. A 55-gallon drum is about 22 inches, or a little bit larger than that. And we also realize that the actual technical term is drum rather than barrel. So we need to, we've changed the definition piece. The amendment that you provided changes the definition, but in that section there are still several references to barrel that I think you may want to still clean up, so it just would read a drum used for baiting.
So, Madam Chair, if we could vote on the first two amendments, and then we'll get the other technical amendments ready for a few moments later in the committee.
Is there any other discussion to the oral amendments? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
I'm sorry.
Could you read the first one, please?
Okay, and then, Madam Chair?
Excuse me, just a minute, Representative Gale. There was a question. Representative Falk, we just wanted those two oral amendments repeated.
Just the first one, please.
Or the first one.
On line 11.13, we would delete town or.
Representative Falk, was that the only one that you wanted? Okay, thank you. Right, if there are no further questions regarding these oral amendments, all in favor of the oral amendments? vote, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Yeah.
Amendment adopted.
All right, now, Madam Chair, Representative Olin has an amendment. I'd like to move amendment 1283A3 and have Representative Olin come up and discuss the amendment. And I assume that the amendment is in hand. Okay, that's the A3 amendment.
Yes, Representative Bill, it is.
Okay, I'll give you the quick version of what the amendment does. It right now there presently is an elk management plan statute, but it was put into effect in 1987. There were some rules made in 1998, but really it's never been fully implemented, and we now have considerably more elk in the state of Minnesota than we had in that plan. The plan originally only anticipated some elk that were in Grigla, Minnesota at that time, which would be Marshall County and maybe into Beltrami, although not very often. Now we have a considerable amount and probably more elk in Pittston County than we do in Marshall County. So what we need is an update on the plan, and I have one oral amendment that I would ask Representative Bill to make if he can read my scribbling.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment to the amendment, and I'll have the scribbler explain it.
At the very end of the plan...
Representative.
Yes. Thank you. At the very end of the plan, it says, until the elk population reaches. At that stage, put 30 or less in Marshall County and 30 or less in Kitson County to anticipate both plans that presently, or both groups that presently exist. The present plan existing says 30 in Kitson County, or in Marshall County only. And by the way, the last count there was 53, and there's probably close to 80 or 90 in Lancaster area in Kitson. So that's basically what the amendment's got. I've got two or three testifiers that'll give a little more information on them, and I'll call on.
Okay, Representative Olin, I would just like to clarify this. I think we want to make sure that we get it correct,
okay.
And that your oral amendment was on 1.13.
Right.
After the word reaches, you wanted to scratch 55 or less and
correct.
Insert instead 30 or less in Marshall County and 30 or less in Kitson County.
That would be correct.
All right. Are there any questions regarding the oral amendment? If not, all in favor of adopting that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Now, if you would like to bring your testifiers up, Representative Olin.
I believe there's going to be probably one or two from Marshall County and one or two from Kitson. I'll try to limit their time here by hitting them on the head if they go too long or something. First one is Gary Sater, and he's from Marshall County in Grigla. Yep.
Gary Sater, Grigla, Minnesota. I'm a farmer.
Welcome to the committee, and we're looking forward to your testimony. Please go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm here. Actually, I was down here 22 years ago. We were having the same problem, and I was with the group that got the first group passed, and it seems like nothing has been done since. The herd has gradually gotten up, and the DNR counts at 53, and in reality it's maybe closer to 80, and the depredation problem is getting worse and worse. So we'd like to get this management plan to keep it at like Olin said, Representative Olin said, under 30. And that's what the farmers at that time kind of okayed and signed off with. And since then, it's really gotten out of hand. And that's about all I got to say.
Thank you.
Second witness is from...
Representative Owen.
Second one's also from Marshall County.
Welcome to committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Ronald Engelstead from Marshall County. Hold the mic up a little closer. I'm Ronald Engelstead from Marshall County, Grigla, Minnesota. And we have a management plan that you have seen, I think, that states 30 or less. And that's what we want it to be. And if the plan we got, if that's implemented the way it should be, it wouldn't be by near the problem. And one thing with this, we have very few people that have a problem. But if you have the problem, it's a big problem. Because elk herd up like cattle do. And it isn't just what they eat, it's what they lay on and trample. And right now we have crop prices up, and the damage, herd number is up, so there's a lot more damage than we've had in the past. So that's about all I got to say.
Thank you, Mr. Lingelstad, for your testimony. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll now call on Joe Olefsky from the Lancaster Group to explain. There's pictures being passed around, and Joe probably knows those better than I do.
Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Joe Olefsky. I'm from Lancaster, Minnesota. I come over 400 miles for this. I give you an idea. I live about a mile from the Canadian border and about 20 miles from the North Dakota border. You got a bunch of... There's a picture there with my... there's six sections on it. Yep, that's the one. I've been to meetings down here over the last year, and when I expressed all the problems I have with the elk, I've also had been blessed with timber wolf problems, but with the elk, people can't figure that it comes that close to my dwelling and stuff. And there's another picture on there with 19 elk in one herd. That's off my property. They come in the spring of the year, you know, and eat, and how do you determine the damage and stuff like that. And then I fix a lot of fence. Since last June I kept track every time I fix fence in front of elk, and it's getting awful old. And I think we need a lot more communication and way better management on behalf of the DNR. I'm a third generation farmer, and I think I'm glass, because my boys, they see what I'm going through, and it's just a pain, and they're tired of it. I never did this before, so I guess I'm open for any questions, and if somebody wants to talk to me after, I come 400 miles, I want to visit.
Are there any questions for the testifier?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dell.
Well, for the testifier's relaxation, most of the people in here have never farmed before, so I think that's a mutual respect that they have for you.
Well, it's too bad then, because it's going to take me more than 4 minutes to fill you in.
If there are no further questions for this testifier, excuse me, Representative Olin.
Well, yeah, I probably should mention, there's up in Kitson County where I'm from, there's actually three different herds, like there's Lancaster herd, I don't know if there's a handout here or not, there's a water tower herd, and then there's a caribou herd which goes up into Manitoba also. There's farmers there that I guess I've been blessed. They haven't come into my dwelling, but I mean, you can see on there where they've been within a mile, and they come into these farmers' yard, and they go right on their storage feed, on their silage, on their hay, and once they urinate, you know, crap, whatever, the cattle just don't eat it. It's a waste. So some farmers have a whole lot of problem, and my problem is I've lost hay three times in my life to fire, and I don't feel that I want to take that chance and bring it all home. So I haul my hay as I need it. I can haul when there's 2 feet of snow. I got the equipment to do it, and they expect me to haul it off on the elk's term instead of my farming operation, and and I think maybe it should be a two-way street. I don't think I should have to operate my farm around the elk's wishes. So if there's any other questions.
Are there any other questions for this testifier? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to
Representative Dill.
Renew my motion for the A3 amendment as amended to House File 1283.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, Representative Dill, did you want to, I'm just curious if we could hear from the DNR, are you wanting to, how are we going to be, I just have some questions for the DNR in regards to the herd, if I could.
If we could hear from Mr. Boggess, I believe.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe if I could start if Mr. Boggess is coming down. Mr. Boggess, I understand these guys have got some serious issues. Specifically, I think sometimes you get in some real close situations where these herds, I can't imagine 20 of them being in a green alfalfa field in August, or a green soybean field, in August or something. But have we ever entertained the idea on how much we could generate? I mean, instead of having these guys shoot them in March when they don't have antlers on them, why aren't we auctioning off some of these trophies to be shot in the fall season when we could generate the money that these guys need, I'm thinking, and thin the herd? Have we looked at that possibility? Some of these hunts go for huge amounts of money, I know, out west.
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Ed Boggess, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the DNR, and Representative McNamara, there has been some discussion of auctioning off individual licenses with some of the groups over the years. I guess generally the department's not been very supportive of the idea of auctioning to the highest bidder just because of the fact that then it's a very limited elk, like moose, is a once in a lifetime opportunity. And I don't know the number off the top of my head. I was asked it a little bit ago and I think I have it with me, but we have a lot of people that would like to be able to hunt elk. A lot more apply than are drawn for, obviously. This last year we had more elk permits than we've had in 150 years in Minnesota offered in the state, and it was only 22 or 23 permits. So, and there are several thousand people that applied for those. So you're right, some of the western states do auction off some of these, like bighorn sheep or very, very highly priced permits, and they probably would generate a lot of money, but then it becomes kind of the person that has the money kind of moves to the front of the line, and that's just not a concept that we've really supported in the past.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Boggess, what kind of money are we talking about? I hate to see us just annihilate the herd. How much money are we talking about to properly fund this program for the damages that the herd's causing?
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, the state of Minnesota has laws that the state doesn't pay for wildlife damage, with two exceptions, and those two are gray wolves and elk. And the state, since federal protection of wolves, or at least since the late 1970s, the state has paid compensation for wolf damage. After the laws that were passed in the mid-1980s that required the DNR to remove the elk from the Griggle area, we made an attempt to do that. They were not very successful. There were lawsuits filed, there were injunctions, and after that law was repealed, and the authority to hunt the elk and the compensation for elk damage were passed. Since that time, the Department of Agriculture has administered a compensation program for both elk and wolf damage. That appropriation was increased to $100,000 a few years ago, and that's been sufficient up until the last couple of years to cover the amount of damage, and it's general fund money. But the last couple of years, they've been running behind on the damage with the amount of money in there. So there is a proposal. In fact, it's in front of Representative Junkie's Ag Finance Committee tomorrow that would up that to $150,000. That should keep up with the recent rate of elk damage. But we're also committed to finalizing a plan that would try to manage this herd at a lower level. You know, the exact number, I guess, I think we still have some concerns about, because there's part of this herd is shared with Manitoba, but we think the amount of money that's currently in that compensation program, which if the proposal from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture passes, would be $150,000 a year, and that's currently coming out of the general fund. It's a long answer to a short question.
Just one real
quick. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the only other follow-up, is the cropping any different in Manitoba? And I guess I should have probably asked the testifiers. They may know that better. And does Manitoba have any compensation back to them? Do they have cropping similar when they cross the river? Do they have soybean fields and sunflowers? And do you know, do they do any compensation for the landowners? And maybe one of the testifiers, Mr. Boggess, if you don't know, maybe if one of the testifiers know if they could answer that question.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I don't know the answer to that for sure.
Please state your name again. Thank
you. I'm Joel Olevsky. My mother and my wife's mother both came from Canada. I got relatives over there, so I kind of know a little bit what's going on. They want an elk season just as much as we do. I mean, they want to get rid of some elk management. The biggest problem up there that I know of is getting into the farms and stored feed, like a few of us, two farmers on Lancaster. And they do have programs up there for fencing out the feed. That I know for sure. But the area that the elk go to up there, there isn't as much like soybeans and that. It's a lot of dairy in that area up by Bite on our back on in Manitoba. Did I answer your question?
Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question would go to Mr. Boggess again. When the departments or the DNR is tasked with managing the herd, what happens to those animals? I mean, or the remains, is that used for processing? Is it donated to a food shelf for the meat? Or, I mean, do you have a process in place?
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, yes, we'd like to do it as much as we could through hunting licenses, and there the hunters, you know, put in an application, pay a fee, get a license, and they keep the meat. When it's a shooting permit situation, we have a carcass disposition plan where the landowner can shoot the deer or the elk and field dress it, and then it's donated to food shelves in the local area.
Mr. Boggess, I had one question on changing the 100,000 up to 150,000. When you said that it would be sufficient, I was just would like a little bit more information on who said it would be efficient. Is that the DNR? Is that the landowners, the Department of Ag, or all three?
Madam Chair, I think maybe Representative Olin wants to weigh in on that, but that's the Department of Agriculture program, and it's Department of Agriculture money, and I think they've just been looking at the history of payments and the backlog that they've built up and feel that that would be sufficient to cover that, but that's not, it's not our program, so I can't speak authoritatively to it. Sorry.
Now, Representative Olin, just a quick comment on that. Actually, the 150 you referred to is what Department of Ag's request is. I actually requested 100,000 beyond what they requested in the bill that's going into committee tomorrow. Plus, I asked for 50,000 to handle what's been happening in this last fiscal year 2009, because we're already at 112,000 when they only had 100,000 in the budget. I know there's another 20,000 out there.
Are there any further questions on this amendment? Not all in favor of the H1238A3 amendment. Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Carried.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just for the record, that was the A3 amendment as amended, so that we get that on the record. Thank you. Now, Madam Chair, I'd like to go to the bill. Since Mr. Boggess is up here, there are quite a few sections in the bill that are DNR requests. I'll get started if it pleases the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fairfield. Go ahead.
Section 1 of the bill fulfills 2008 requirements regarding aquaculture licenses. So that, unless there, and if you have questions, I'd be good to address them as we go. Section 3 through 4, 5, and 6 have to do with the refunds of registrations on off-highway motorcycles, off-highway vehicles, off-road vehicles, snowmobiles, and ATVs when the vehicle was registered incorrectly or it was registered once by the dealer and then once later incorrectly by the owner. So it authorizes the, and if I get this wrong, Mr. Boggess, jump in on top of me here, that it gives them the ability to make a refund in those particular items. Now, Section 9 is the ANZIL bill, House File 150, and frankly, there are some problems with this part of this bill, Madam Chair.
Representative Dill, did you mean Section 7, Subdivision 9?
Yes, I'm sorry. Section 7, Subdivision 9 starts on line 3.13. House File 150 of ANZILs, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to have the DNR state what the problems are, and Madam Chair, we're going to be what their problems are with the sections of the bill relative to House File 150. And I tried to contact Representative Anzell today after session. I wasn't able to get together with him, nor was Mr. Meyer. And so I suspect that in the policy committee, we may have some changes that will get made to this bill along the way. So the first thing that I see problem with it is starting on line 3.29, which is Section C, it says that shall review the safe trail. The DNR shall review the safe trail to identify which ones accommodate the use by permanently disabled alongside the trails and designate identified trails for all-terrain vehicle use and publish them in the state register, etc. I see that as possibly a quite large fiscal note. They would basically have to go through the entire system statewide and inventory that and then publish it in the state register, and I think we have a ways to go on that particular section. I see a few members wagging their head as well, so that section is problematic. I'd like to hear from the DNR though on that section if Mr. Meyer could come forward. And frankly, Madam Chair, I'm making some notes because we're going to meet with Representative Anzell and try and get this straightened out.
Madam Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I was out of the room for part of the discussion, but I think I know the gist of it this session. I have been talking with the author and trying to get in touch with Representative Anzell about the language as well, but we do remain concerned that this language, as it's drafted, beginning on 3.29, the Commissioner shall review the state's trails to identify trails that would accommodate use by the permanently disabled all-terrain vehicles alongside the trail. This would require us to go back and look at all trails. It's not the straight state trails, the designated state trail system. The language that here is all of the trails that we have, a trail in a park, a trail in anywhere, a forest trail, all of our trail system. It will, depending on how we do it, if we did it at the detail it probably deserves, would have a large cost to it and take us some time. If you think, Madam Chair, of our forest designation process that we accomplished July 31st, 2009, that was a multi-year project and a large undertaking that just dealt with the trails in the state forest. So this would encompass us to look at all of the trails statewide. And current statute under 85.018 does provide for opportunities for disabled people to ride on the designated trails, the tar trails, in a powerized wheelchair or other means. It doesn't allow a motorized vehicle on the trails, but it does allow them access by their traditional mode of transportation, I believe, this motorized wheelchair and other types of activities in that level. But to go back and evaluate the entire state trail system for people to use ATVs on the side of them, they were never purchased or developed that way. Most of our trails were easements we purchased for roughly 33 feet We negotiated with the private landowners to buy that easement, most cases on a specific use, i.e. non-motorized biking trail, a horse trail, snowmobile trail system, things of that nature. So to come back and allow this activity may be problematic for those landowners as well. It is an issue that I was hoping to be able to discuss with Roger Hulk and others, but I don't see them here today as well. Trying to figure out where this came from and what the problem is people are trying to solve. If it's access, we believe they already have access under 85.018. If it's hunting, if the purpose is to provide people a permit to ride the trail system to hunt, well, you can't really hunt off of the trail system. Most cases, it's like I had mentioned, it's a 33-foot easement we purchased with no contiguous land on either side of it. So a person wouldn't legally be able to discharge a weapon throughout most areas of the system. If it's a state trail in a forest, now that's a lot different. But if you're looking at a corridor system, it is very problematic if that's the intent there. So it's an issue we're trying to figure out what the goal is or what people are trying to solve and try to work with people on that, but we do have some concerns with the way the language is in the bill right now.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. Are there any questions for Commissioner Meyer? Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, Representative Dill, what you want to do here. Do you want to leave it in the bill and then maybe fix it Thursday or Wednesday or whenever we're going to hear this again? Or do you want, I'd be happy to delete this section out, that's section C, because I don't believe we should have that in the bill. But so I'd like to make a motion to do that, unless you want to just leave it, and we'll talk to Anzell and figure out from there what you want to do. But I think we should take that out of the bill.
Well, my intent, Madam Chair, my intent was is to leave it in for today, okay. Meet with Anzell tomorrow or Wednesday, and then I think Mr. Stelka, is it Thursday we're going to hear the bill? In environment policy?
It'll be on Wednesday.
Or Wednesday. And if we don't come to some resolution between myself, Representative Anzels, and the commissioner, then I will delete it out of the bill at that time. I guess it's just in respect to Representative Anzell, I would prefer to leave it in today, but I agree with you. It's just completely fraught with problems. So I think that we should take it out then, if that's acceptable. Although I certainly don't want to inhibit you from making a motion.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
As long as we talk about it again on Wednesday.
Very good.
Are there any further questions? It sounds like we will be dealing with this Subdivision 9 in detail on Wednesday.
Okay, next item, Madam Chair, Section 8.
Representative Dill.
And that has to do with the same as the refunds that we talked about earlier in the bill, except these have to do with, this section has to do with boats. So it's identical language except that this is boats. And so we've covered all of them, ATV, ORV, snowmobile, so on and so forth. Then Section 9, Madam Chair, is really a technical matter on line 4.15. Right now the department provides the fishing laws and summaries that illustrate the vast patchwork of information that's in that document, and they give them to the licensed vendors, not the county auditors, because the county auditors no longer issue licenses, as I understand it. So this is more of a common sense technical issue. Section 10 is a similar thing in terms of common sense, because there are few electric motors. This has to do with waterfowl feeding and resting areas that are designated by the commissioner. There are very few, I don't even recall seeing any in recent times, electric motors that are 30-pound thrust or less. I mean, they're substantially more than that because of technology advances. So what this section of the bill does, starting on line 4.34, is say that it may be powered with a 12-volt battery or less, because that would be a more common way to regulate that type of motor in a wildlife resting area. Section 11 has to do with ATVs and cities, and I spoke to Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities today, and I'm going to have Commissioner Meyer explain this part. It's a little bit technical, But I will tell you that Mr. Johnson from the LMC told me that they were fine with the language. So if the chair would give Commissioner Meyer the latitude to explain this portion of the bill.
Madam Chair, members, this is some language that actually arose from our wildlife management area encroachment stakeholder meetings that we had 2 years ago. We came forward with recommendations last year. Unfortunately, those did not get enacted. And it doesn't deal anything with ATVs. I think you had said ATVs represented the deal. What it really allows for is... It must be on the brain, yeah.
Sorry about that. Stand corrected.
It allows for us to come up with an agreement with local units of government on the encroachment issues that we're seeing rapidly approach our wildlife management areas. And it's two pieces. One dealing with tracts that are 160 contiguous acres or larger. There's the first pieces here starting is on from 5.5 and then... you can see it's in A and then B there. So wildlife management areas that are 160 acres or larger would be exempt from local ordinances that limit the use and management of the unit as authorized by law. These are our larger parcels in outstate Minnesota. Those areas aren't going to prohibit hunting in their townships or those parts of the city. That none of these are in cities, first of all, let me say that. The townships would not enact a provision that would prohibit somebody from hunting on property of this size, and it's our intentions that we want to protect these tracts of land as we move forward. Section B allows for tracts of land that are 40 acres of contiguous up to 160 acres to be exempt from local ordinances that would restrict trapping, restrict the discharge of archery equipment, restrict the discharge of shotguns with shot sizes of number 4 buckshot or smaller diameter. And also in my conversations with Representative Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities, he had questioned the term buckshot. Now, in other places of statute, buckshot is the term we use referring to shot size. So we may need to clean that up as we move forward between this committee and the policy committee to make sure that buckshot isn't referring to the larger shot size, but it's referring, this is dealing with fine shots. So what we're really talking about is number 4, a smaller diameter shot. Representative, I don't know if you have the correct term of art for that at all, but...
Well, Madam Chair...
Representative Steele.
I know that number 4 buckshot is a really large shot when in a kind of a standard shotgun shell you'd only have maybe 9 to 13 pellets in it. And number 4 shot is a whole different breed of cat. That's more for the taking of a duck or a goose. So there's quite a bit of difference in that. And there's also quite a bit of difference in the lethal range of those two things. So that's something that we better visit. I agree we better visit with those folks and find out what we're going to put in there. And we'll do that before the next stop.
So what we're trying to protect is the ability to shoot fine shots for taking upland game, such as pheasants, things like that. Also, the restrictions on noise, which would be a firearm discharge. Any ordinance that would require a dog to be on a leash or anything that would restrict restrict the management of the unit as authorized by state law. These units are the smaller units that we have out here, and actually in talking with the League of Minnesota Cities, they support this whole concept. And there was a provision that was enacted last year dealing with the city of Columbus where large parts of Carlos Avery's reside, and they had agreed to actually not passing any ordinances that would prohibit the management of that unit. If they do, they would not be eligible for PILT. We changed the PILT payments for that city last year because they're the only city that is eligible for PILT payments because they were incorporated into or annexed into the city of Columbus last year. So people understand that they want to protect these uses, and I think there's fair support. But I don't know of anybody who's come out against this provision. But it's a piece we're looking forward to protect our WMAs as we have them in the future.
Representative Haskbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I agree with you, Commissioner Meyer. It's a good thing to do, but it doesn't go far enough as far as I'm concerned. So these particular areas, between 40 and 160 acres, if the city did want to pass an ordinance to say that you're not going to be able to hunt deer with a slug, or you might currently be able to do that now, according to this language, they can come in and do that. Is that correct? Madam Chair, in my city, we have wildlife management area. And I think it's like 80 acres or 100 acres. And right now, you can hunt deer on this with a shotgun plus. But now this says, it doesn't mention that at all, that you're going to say that that city can't pass an ordinance. They could pass an ordinance after this law passes that says, we're not going to allow shotgun deer hunting on that 100 acres. And that's not right, especially when you're already allowing it to take place. And especially in some agreements that, you know, they probably find when they put this wildlife management area in. But if you pass this law, now that kind of opens that door. So I don't know that
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, that is a good point, and I think as we begin to re-examine this section in the next day and a half, there's an issue we will try to come to grips with and work to come up with a solution, because that's not our intent. We're protecting the right to discharge archery equipment and noise, but perhaps we can come to some agreement with the stakeholders that would allow us to protect the classifications or the uses that are currently there. Upon enactment, is that kind of the way you're thinking?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Meyer, that's exactly where I wanted to go off. We can come up with some language that says that if we're already allowing shotgun slug hunting in these areas, that should stay in place. I don't know how you word that, well, but something along those lines.
Madam Chair, we'll work on something, some language. I'll work with you and Representative Hackbarth to come up with something that meets your needs, and
great.
Hopefully you can help us off with that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm thinking that would go in somewhere in that on line 5.14 or thereabouts, where it talks about restricting the discharge of shotguns in that item. And so I have written a note, Representative Hackbarth, that we'll be fixing that, because you're absolutely right. I don't want that, what you described, to happen.
Is there any further questions on this point?
Okay, Madam Chair. Section 12 is the TOW bill, House File 477, which allows, prior to September 16th, a portable stand may be left overnight in the WMA by a person who has a registered bait and hunting within 100 yards of the bait site. And also, that as well, the person leaving the portable stand overnight must affix their name and address in the stand in such a manner that it can be read from the ground. And I think that's relatively straightforward. If anyone, the reason it has a date of September 16th, I believe that's the first 2 weeks, the end of the first 2 weeks in general of the bear season, and that's when most bear are taken anyway in that first 2 weeks. And after that, there's a conflict with the portable stand versus the archery for the taking of deer. Isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, this date coincides with the opening of small game season and also archery deer season. So we're trying to reduce or eliminate a conflict that the archer, the bow hunting, the deer archery person may have with a bear, or person hunting bear with a stand left overnight. So reducing this preemption, so to speak, by other people.
And Section 13 is regarding the inconsistency between small game convictions and trapping, and this language would make trapping and small game have the same type of a conviction. Of course, that's a consistency issue. Section 14. Mr. Meyer, can you explain that one?
Madam Chair, this is just clarifying language dealing with the Take Kid Fishing Weekends. The previous said a resident over age 18, and we want to just change it to a resident 16 years of age or older can take fish during these weekends if accompanied by a person who is under age 16 as it currently is right now. Right now, it was kind of a gray area, if you want to say that. So you had to be over 16 to legally fish with a child who was under age 16. So if you were 17, you had to be over age 18. So the 17-year-old
couldn't
fish for free. Not that I don't think we ever enforced it that way, I hope, but we want to make sure that the intent is that people can fish for free during that weekend if you're with a child.
Madam Chair, that's actually, isn't that during two different, you've got open water and ice fishing, so it's actually 2 3-day periods. Okay, then Section 15, angling in a state park, a resident may take fish
without an angling license within a state park from a boat or float. Now, I had a question on line 6.26. It says applies to those waters completely encompassed within a state park. So if it were a river, my question would be to the department, to Mr. Bogus, if it were a river that flowed through a park from outside the park to outside the park, would that be included in the encompassed within the state park? Is the intent meaning that as long as you're fishing within the state park, you can do so without a license? That's a technical issue on 6.26.
Mr. Bogus.
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, perhaps this could use some clarification, but the intent of the language, and this was a provision that came from the department, was that if you're shore fishing or wading within a state park, you don't need a license. However, if you're angling from a boat or a float, you don't need a license, only on those water bodies that are completely contained within that park. So on a river or a lake that's a river that flows through a park or a lake that's only partially within the park, if you're in a boat or floating on the water, you wouldn't then need a license. It's only fishing from shore that you would be exempt from a license, unless the whole lake was within the state park. So that was our intent. If it needs to be worded a little more clearly, we could certainly look at that.
And that'd be an item that will, Madam Chair, that we'll clarify. It just struck me that my very efficient conservation officer might interpret that differently than what Mr. Bogus interpreted it. And I agree with his interpretation. I just think that we need a little help. And right, just on, yeah. All right. And then section 16 is regarding whitefish and Cisco netting. The way I understand it, you have to have a license to net Ciscos or whitefish, but yet there's nothing in the ELS so that you can get a license if you're under 16 for this venture. And so we are going to have an amendment at the next stop that says that this would be effective after, when is the ELS date? March what?
First.
March 1st, 2009, so that the ELS can catch up with what the language intends here. And this is kind of a technical thing, actually. You know, normally if you're under 16, you can fish, but apparently maybe Mr. Bogus can tell us if that's in rule or statute, must be in statute, that you have to have a license. It's in statute that you have to have a license, regardless of your age, to do Cisco or whitefish netting. Something that's really popular up in the north. And so that's what, this is a semi-technical thing that will be amended to include the capability of the ELS system.
Representative McNamara.
Representative Dill, why don't we just exempt 16 and under and allow them to net Cisco and whitefish for personal consumption? Wouldn't that be a simpler way? Is there a reason why?
Well,
Representative Dill.
I really thought that was a good idea, but maybe we better have Commissioner Meyer come down and tell us why that's not a good idea. Got you on the spot. Pardon me?
Oh, they got it.
They're going to get back to you, but it has to do with tagging the nets and having an ID number on every net. And if someone that is 16 years and younger doesn't have a license, then they don't have a number to tag on their net. So there's a requirement, Madam Chair, that requires identification, including the license number on a net, because it's left unattended. And the conservation officer, as I understand it, would go out and see the net unattended, but it had no license. That would be a no license number. That's because the youth couldn't get a license because there is no such license. And so, therefore, they'd be leaving the net without any identification on it, and they all, you know, probably have to have a special investigation into it.
Representative McNamara.
Well, just a quick follow-up. I was envisioning most of these young folks would be accompanying someone older. It's not necessarily, though. They could be 15 and have their own nets out there, and that's what you're trying to cover. Because if they were with somebody, I mean, these guys weren't getting pinched when they were 15 along with their dad pulling in the net, and they were breaking the law. Is that what I'd be understanding that under current law?
when my son, Madam Chair, well, I have never gotten a whitefish netting license. But if my son were to go over to the Vermilion Gorge and net, he wouldn't be able to identify the net because he couldn't get a license. But yet it requires that it have a license number and identification on the net. So there's an example of when he would be fishing for netting without me having a license, and him doing it essentially illegally, not following the rules and regulations. I frankly would have rather had it so they don't have to have one at all and put their name on it or something, but that isn't going to work apparently.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Daly, your son is older than 16 now. You better remember that. He needs a license now.
Well, Madam Chair, he's never whitefish netted either. I was just using him as an example. Okay,
Representative Corney's
question. Well, not so much a question as a comment, just so you can realize how important the name and the netting tag is that these nets are set a lot up in up north for whitefish or tulabies or whatever they call them, Cisco. I forget the terminology, but it's a pretty popular thing. They smoke them and pickle them, but a number of game fish are caught accidentally, and they have to be released. And sometimes if people don't set them right in the right depth of water, set them properly, you can take quite a number of game fish. And so that's why it's important you have the tag on them so that they can find out who's putting these things out and get a hold of them. So the tag is an important part of it, however we figure the bill out and work it out, just so we keep the identification on them. So.
Representative Dill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. The next item is a DNR provision starting on line 7.1.
Madam Chair and members, this would roll back a provision that went into law on March 1st that would require youth under the age of 16 to obtain a free small game license. We understood and supported the intent behind this, but we were concerned about the unintended consequence of this perhaps becoming a barrier to participation. The intent was so we would know how many youth under the age of 16 are taking or are hunting small game, but we're just concerned that it might become a barrier to participation. We're trying to get rid of those types of barriers.
And Madam Chair, that is the one of the chair's provisions from last year's bill. And I don't agree with this, so what I'm going to do is come in with an amendment that says that it'll be effective March 1, 2009, when the ELS is capable of being easily programmed. And frankly, I think that youth should get in the habit of going as soon as possible to get a license, but we're going to work on that. I mean, we need to train them to have a license. And I mean, the DNR is always illustrating how important training is. Regardless of what, whether it's reading the rule book or knowing your zones or whether to have your gun cased or uncased or loaded or unloaded, I mean, it's always a very important part of their training. And so it would just seem to me that this would be natural, too, to have them out there, going through the exercise of going down. I mean, they go down to the convenience store to get a bottle of pop. It would seem that they can go down there and also get a license and a pop at the same time. So even though I included in the bill, in the interest of fair chase, I don't necessarily agree with it. Section 18. This is Representative Hagbarth's bill. It's very simple. Right now we give a free license to veterans, and this would allow for the taking of either a deer of either sex on that free license. And then if they wanted to buy another license, then they would have to follow the regular rules and regulations that govern licenses. So that only has to do solely with the free license that we already issue them under law. So there's no real fiscal impact in that. It's just that the impact would be on the sex of the deer that they actually take. And Madam Chair, Section 19 is a technical amendment on line 8.10 that clarifies that a person can take a deer, a non-resident can take a deer 18 years or older, and that the fee is $135. Did I get that right? Thought so. All right, and then Section 20 is Representative Junkie's two-line fishing bill, which is very popular with the department. And also then that section is the taking of for non-resident dark house spearing. Is that the same bill? I'm sorry. That's only for dark house spearing. So Section 20 is for dark house spearing, which would allow for $37.50 a person to get a dark house spearing license that is a non-resident. Remember, we had quite a discussion on that bill here in the committee. Then Section 21 is adding the word or shelter into all of these different aspects of fish houses, dark houses, and shelters for residents and non-residents. And is that's basically a technical item, is it not?
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, yes, it is. Just because if someone isn't fishing out of it, it's not necessarily a fish house. It could be just a shelter out there. And then on line 9.16, it adds the dark house for non-residents to correspond with what Representative Dill just talked about.
Representative Hagler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Now, does this say that you have to have portable lights? I don't know if the definition is shown here of shelter. Does this now mean that portable fish houses will have to be licensed?
Madam Chair and Representative Hackbarth, the licensing is in Section 40, which is on page 15, where we have a similar change in wording, and it just says that a person may not leave a dark house, fish house, or shelter unattended at any time between midnight and 1 hour before sunrise unless the house or shelter is licensed. So as long as it's portable and it's not being left out there overnight, it does not have to be licensed.
Okay. That's the technicality.
Yes. Right. It's the overnight part that makes it have to be licensed.
Right. And, you know, Representative Chair, this has been rather problematic trying to get just to where we are in this language, because I can't remember how many sessions that we've been fooling around with this language and different variations trying to get it right. I remember that Senator Bach had a bill, and maybe it was you, Representative Hagbarth, that had the other companion bill here in the House where we started this process, and we're still at it trying to figure out exactly how to get at the problem, and the overnight is the key thing, as I understand it. All right, and Section 29 is regarding it fulfilled 2008 legislation that required. Why don't you explain exactly how that works? But it is regarding 2008 legislation.
Yeah. Madam Chair, remember, Section 23 deals with the same issue that was in Sections 1 and 2. It's in both the fees for aquatic farms and for private fish hatcheries are the same, but some of them are in Chapter 17 Ag Statutes, and some are in Chapter 97A, and this just allows us to establish the fees that were required by 2008 law for private fish hatcheries without going through the full Chapter 14 rulemaking process, which is a very lengthy and expensive process.
Okay, and then section, starting on line 10.1, which is section 24, this has to do with a person sending a wild animal that they've taken at properly licensed to a taxidermist, a tanner, or a fur buyer. As I understand it, formally you could do that within the state by common carrier, but we also need to be able to send it out of state as well by common carrier, and that's what this language does. So if a person lived in Minnesota and took a elk up in Grigla, he'd be able to send that to Colorado, where they commonly do taxidermy work on elk. Is that correct, Mr. Bobby?
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, yes, this would allow wild animals to be shipped to taxidermists, tanners, or fur buyers by, parcel post or UPS or whatever common carrier a person wants to. And it would also, there's a repealer associated with this, because it would also make the law for residents and non-residents the same. In the past, actually, non-residents had more freedom to do this than residents did.
Okay, Section 25 is beginning.
Representative Dale, I just had a question for Mr. Boggess on that issue. Just wondering, since we are being so very precise about so many terms throughout this, I just wondered if there had ever been any questions about making sure that this wild animal was a dead wild animal.
That's a good question. Madam Chair, and we do have another part of this bill that talks about live versus dead.
So, Madam Chair, what you're saying in this in illustration would be that someone captures an elk, puts it in a trailer, and takes it to Colorado to have it then dispatched and taxidermied.
Representative Dill, yeah, that is kind of what I was getting at. But, I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but actually we are so precise about unlicensed, this license, that license, I just wondered if there was any potential for this to cause problems for something, say, smaller, like maybe a grouse or something.
Madam Chair, we do have... The department does have rules that doesn't allow people to take protected species from the site where taken alive, but there's another piece actually of this bill that deals with coyotes, live coyotes, and so I think you're raising a valid point that we don't want people shipping those live coyotes.
I will have a Madam Chair, I'll have, we'll have that, I'm making a list here of the things to fix as we go, these technical items, we'll have that one on the list as well.
Thank you, Representative Dill.
Section 25 begins the discussion on uncased firearms or bows or crossbows. And I want to bring to your attention something that we found in this language. If you look at line 10.10, it says a person may not possess a crossbow outdoors or, and then unless the bow is not armed and without a bolt or an arrow. So what we're trying to figure out, we haven't actually figured it out yet, is I know what the purpose of this is, but also what if someone is target practicing outside in their backyard or at their friend's house target practicing with a crossbow? It says in this that you may not possess a crossbow outdoors and that the bow must not be armed or with a bolt or arrow. So we're trying to figure out that technicality as well. Otherwise, this is the beginning of the uncased portion of this bill. And then section 26 line 10.21 in this section, can you explain that, Mr. Bogus?
Excuse me, Mr. Bogus, Representative Falk.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a question. I mean, really, it just seems like even the subdivision 2 of section 25 is overly litigious. I mean, is it really needed? I mean the whole portion about if you're in your backyard you can't go out and practice your crossbow. It seems pretty ridiculous to me.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Dill,
the language I cited is actually in current law, not something that we're putting into law. That's current law, and you're right. The reason I questioned it is it seems rather ridiculous, but there must be a reason for it, and that reason I have yet to discover. And Commissioner Meyer and I were discussing it, and Mr. Kadelka, and we're trying to get our arms around why that says what it says. And just to be honest with you, we don't have the answer yet. This happened about 4:20 before this hearing began that the question came up.
Representative Dill.
Section 26, Mr. Boggs.
Madam Chair, members, the Section 26 deals with the muzzleloader season and allowing only firearms that are legal for use. It actually covers all the seasons, but only firearms that are legal for use during the respective season. Under current law, technically a person hunting during the muzzleloader season could have a high-powered rifle in their possession. So this would just make it clear that they can have firearm and ammunition authorized for taking big game in that area and during that season. And in addition, the exemption for the rimfire calibers would still apply.
And then, Madam Chair, on line 10.23, it continues with the discussion, some small amendments to the statute that regarding unloaded firearm. Line 2, section 27, that is the crux of the uncased portion of the bill. And I'll just quickly go through it. At line 11.9, a person may transport an unloaded, uncased firearm except a pistol under 624.712 subdivision 2, and that is the concealed carry provision. That's the concealed carry provision. At line 11, you may not, within an area where a discharge of firearm has been prohibited under 471.633, which is a section of law that allows a local unit of government
county, city, township, any of those, to promulgate and pass a no discharge ordinance. And then 11.13 then would also make an exception for within the boundaries of a home rule charter or statutory city with a population of 2,500 or more, and then also on school grounds is regulated under the statute that has to do with school 609.66, and then is otherwise restricted under 97, those statutes, which are WMAs, game refuges, and while using night vision. Now let me just go back and give you that section in practicality. It says that you may transport an unloaded, uncased firearm, not a pistol as we discussed, and you may not do it in an area where in a town, a city, or county where there has been a no discharge ordinance. For example, I understand Ely has a new no discharge ordinance, and you wouldn't be able to have an uncased firearm in Ely. I understand that Minneapolis has a no discharge ordinance, but Minneapolis is over 2,500 and so is Ely. And so in line 11.13, they would automatically be exempt. But now let's take a town like Silver Bay. I don't know if they don't have a discharge ordinance or not at this point, but they are under 2,500. So if they were under 2,500 and didn't have a discharge ordinance, or no discharge ordinance, you would be able to have an uncased firearm in that community. So I think that explains it, although I'll answer any questions. So that is that part about the 2,500 or more is a change since the last time this committee saw the bill. And we were trying, frankly, to negotiate with the Minnesota Peace Officers Organization. They were unwilling to negotiate. But we went ahead and put our offer that we had on the table to them in the bill in the interest of goodwill towards those folks.
Representative Hackmar.
Madam Chair, and Representative Dill on 11.16, those statutes that are listed there, did you say that we will still not be able to have an uncased gun in a wildlife management area?
Well, I did say that. I just got to confirm that 97A091 is a WMA.
Madam Chair and Representative Hackmarth and Dell, I think that the game refuges that are closed to hunting are closed to possession of uncased firearms. They're not wildlife management areas. They're state game refuges.
Okay, I'm pretty sure. Okay with that, Chair, if that's what it is, but...
Well, Madam Chair, it is not my intent to do that, just like our original thing about the slugs, and we will check into the technicality of that, because it's absolutely not my intent to, I mean, obviously we'd want to have an uncased firearm in the WMA where we would need it. And I just quickly wrote down from my notes from memory that it was night vision and game refuges and there's a third thing, but we will check on it, and we'll be versed and ready to answer that question at the next committee hearing.
Representative Dill and Representative Hackler, the council informs me that the statutes refer to game refuge, shining, and night vision.
That was what it was, shining. Sorry, I misspoke on that. Okay, and then the next section is House File 150 is ANZELS, and maybe Mr. Bogus would explain that.
Madam Chair and members, I think we still need to talk to the author on this piece. We're not sure exactly what he was trying to do with this, because this is the piece that says that a person that's participating in a hunt sponsored by a nonprofit organization doesn't have to follow the case and unloaded requirements, and so that are actually in Section 27 of the bill, and so not sure if this is doing quite what the author may have intended. We need to work more with Representative Anzell on that.
All right, and then Section 29 has the same thing to do with the uncased section regarding archery bows. And then... Section 30, that must be Section 30, that has to do with the ANZEL bill. and has to do with the validity of an entire lifetime for the applicant, and there's no chance. And again, we're going to go through that. That's the same bill. We're going to go through that tomorrow and either have it fixed or we'll have it out, one of the two, on Wednesday. And then Section 31, this is a kind of a technical change. It has to do with the technology increase, and if Mr. Vargas could explain line 13.15 and 16.
Madam Chair and members, the primary intent of this was just to not limit it to goggle equipment because there's a variety of other night vision equipment, and then it was just our feeling that 13.15 and 16 were not necessary in the game and fish laws because we felt those were allowed under other laws.
And then Section 32 has to do with shooting. This is rather interesting. Shooting from a motor vehicle, stationary motor vehicle. So the gun must be uncased if you're going to discharge it from a stationary motor vehicle. Mr. Bogus, could you explain Section 32?
Madam Chair and members, this, we were required to do a legislative report on trying to remove barriers to participation in disability hunting. One of the barriers that was identified was sometimes the participants in some of these hunts that we do with capable partners and others don't have the vehicle permit to shoot from a stationary motor vehicle that's in 97B055 sub 3 because they don't have a parking sticker or whatever. This would just allow for those special hunts that we do by rule with those organizations. We could put it right in the rule that they could shoot from a stationary motor vehicle without having to get that separate permit.
Just for the committee's information, at the last hearing of this committee, or maybe it was environment policy, I asked for Chief Conrad to come up with a number of people that are licensed each year to discharge a firearm from a stationary motor vehicle, and the number was 815 in 2007 that can shoot from a vehicle with a loaded gun uncased. And I also asked him if there had been any accidents in his memory as a conservation officer, and he said no. So I just wanted that on the record regarding the use of a firearm from a motor vehicle. And thank you very much for that information, Chief Conrad. Very valuable. Then Section 33 has to do with bird feeders and the baiting of deer. So I'll let Mr. Bogus explain that and how this has changed.
Madam Chair and members, this is a provision that we've been tweaking for several sessions now to try to deal with some of the creative ways that people have been figuring out to hunt over bait. There was a change last year that added a bird feeder exemption, but we felt that could lead to ways to get around the baiting law, so that provision that was added to allow bird feeders by the deer stand was is being taken out on lines 13.30 and 31. And then 13.32 is just to clarify that if food has resulted from normal farming or food plots, if it has not been placed by a person, you can hunt over it, but you can't harvest that food plot and then hunt over it. So just trying to make that crystal clear because we've had people interpret that differently or attempt to.
So what we're doing, Madam Chair, is trying to uncreative the creative here in this section.
Yeah.
And then,
Bill, I just wanted to, again, to be very clear, is this going to cause a number of people that have bird feeders to be calling all of us, or are they now not going to be making those phone calls?
Madam Chair and members, we feel that, you know, you can feed birds all you want as long as you're not hunting over that bird feeder. And this language that was added last year actually kind of mirrored what we have up in the bovine TB area where we have a feeding ban, where it's not a hunting related. And there we do have a bird feeding exemption because otherwise people would have been prohibited even from putting out bird feeders. So. We think it makes sense in a feeding ban context, but not in a hunting context, and that as long as it's the bird feeder behind your house, that's fine, as long as you don't have a deer stand sitting over that bird feeder. So we don't We don't believe this is a controversial provision.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and either for Representative Diller or Mr. Bogus. What about in the normal operations of combine? I specifically can remember some good spots where there's been some pretty significant spillage, maybe when a wagon took a corner or they overflowed a combine. That certainly, that food would have been placed by a person. Would this potentially, I mean, I can remember specifically hunting the WMA that we made a point to go back to this one spot where there had been a big spill and the pheasants really hung out there. Would that be considered normal or accepting farming, and at what point would the size of the pile, Chief Conrad, I mean, where would that...
Nice to have you here.
Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Colonel Jim Conrad, Chief of the Division of Enforcement Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair, Representative, in that case, we interpret that not to be a person placing it, but to be part of the process of the harvest of that crop. And therefore, those inadvertent spills, which you cannot avoid in the normal harvest of crops, would not be considered to be bait.
Representative McNamara.
Well, and a real quick follow-up. Colonel, so would you say that it wouldn't be inadvertent if you thought the pile was so large that it made economic sense for the farmer to go out there with a skid steer and pick it up? In other words, you know, if it was dark and he missed the wagon and it was a spill that happened to be in a real strategic spot right next to a WMA with heavy cover, if the pile was so large that it looked like it made sense to go back out and pick it up? Or I'm really curious because I'm thinking of this one instance. It was a pretty good pile, lasted through the whole pheasant season, and I do think it was inadvertent, but it wasn't big enough to pick up with a skid.
Chief Conrad.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. If it would be such a large pile that it would be recoverable, you would expect that the with the value of crops these days, that would be done. But the general spillage, the general waste, in fact, even as you're combining, there's cobs of corn and that sort of stuff left behind. That is acceptable agricultural practice that we would not be enforcing as a baiting situation. However, if you gathered a bunch of that and if an individual gathered a bunch of that and took it to another place that was more conducive to the tree stand that he was shooting from, in that case, yes, now it has been placed and we would consider it to be a baiting situation.
Well, Madam Chair, since we have Chief Conrad, I've got a question then. So, you know, in a farm field, a cornfield, for example, where you might be taking mallards, and you had scouted the field and you found some areas where the combine had stopped to auger into the trailer and some there was spilled on the ground, and we purposely set up our decoys there in that area, that still wouldn't be placed by a person, in other words, the people that were hunting it, but I'm just trying to get down to the technicality of that. You understand the question?
Madam Chair, Representative. If you're talking waterfall, there's a different standard than this, and those are federal regulations that govern that. In the case of the spillage, the small amounts of spillage and stuff, I believe in that context, you would still be able to place your decoys around there and hunt it. It would be in the gathering or redistribution or the addition to what is already there that would be the violation. Okay.
Representative Gill.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, in item in section 34, this has to do with Representative Powell's bill for using the barrel earlier that we changed it to a 30-gallon or larger drum. And we have several amendments here that have been brought to our attention on line 4.18. The word barrel is used twice in that sentence, and it would be needed to be changed to drum. On line 4.19, at the end of the sentence, the same problem, barrel to drum. Line 4.20, two-thirds of the way through the sentence, the word barrel is used as a drum. I'm sorry, if used, we need to change it to a drum. And so, are there any more?
Representative Dill.
14.22 as well.
Okay. I believe we have some questions from council regarding the fact that 14.22 already describes what a barrel is, and that's not correct, that changing barrel in earlier provisions like 14.18 to drum might cause another problem. I don't know if I paraphrased that correctly from council, but...
Well, could we hear what problem that might pose?
Madam Chair, members, it doesn't pose necessarily a problem. It's not necessary since we're defining the term as a 30-gallon or larger drum, so call it a drum or a barrel is really irrelevant because the definition itself is that it's
a drum. So, Madam Chair, when it says that a barrel means, we've clarified what it means at the end of the sentence. Okay, then we need no amendment there. Section 35 has to do with, Mr. Bogus explain that. Now we're back to your question earlier about live transport, etc.
Madam Chair, members, Section 35 is a little bit different than when it was first heard in the in the division, and it's been restricted now. As initially proposed by the department, we would have prohibited take, possession, transportation, et cetera, of live coyotes. We heard some concerns, some people that are doing this within the state. Our primary concern was the movement of disease around the country, and so we've worked with the author and have redrafted this to prohibit the import or export of live coyotes, but not to prohibit their movement within the state or their possession or taking within the state.
Madam Chair, if you will remember the discussion, we had some calls about folks who live trap coyotes and then give them to game farms, and then they let the coyotes go, which then makes tracks through the snow, which then they train hounds on them. And so those are the people that called in and said, geez, we know we can't have something like this or we're going to be out of business. And so that is the genesis of that change. Something I had no idea was going on. I had never heard of it before. Okay, Section 36 has to do with the placing of decoys. If you remember Representative Nelson's bill, and we have a compromise in the works where we changed it previously, or current law, it's 1 hour before lawful shooting of water outfowl. Those people suggested that wasn't enough time to put out a big decoy spread, and I tend to agree with them, so we have compromised on 2 hours. And so that is the change in that section. And then also, then we have the Hackbarth bill. Why don't we have Section 37, why don't we have Representative Hackbarth explain his provision.
Representative Hackbarth.
Madam Chair, this was an issue that we had before the committee twice. On two different Mondays we talked about it when we did Representative Nelson's bill with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then again last Monday, I have a constituent that has a concern with this, and it's just a matter of giving somebody that owns land an extra benefit of leaving their decoys out all the time, and I think it's kind of an unfair advantage, and the constituents thought the same thing, so we brought the bill forward, and we didn't really hear a lot of opposition to it. I see that the Representative Dill did include the change that we talked about, though, where there was a concern that if a lake here or a pond is surrounded by land that one landowner might have, they can do that, and that's fine, and we made that change. So I think that was the only opposition. So maybe Representative Cornish has a comment on that. Does it seem to be okay now, Representative Cornish?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and Representative Hackbarth, yep, it takes care of that. And even though there won't be many exceptions where a single landowner has the whole land around the whole lake, at least it'll take care of, give them the common sense. There's no public access, and they own it. Why not leave them out? So it looks good.
Okay.
Representative McNamara.
Well, Representative Hackbarth, I have one question. I'm nervous about the single landowner, line 15.11. I can think of a case where this pond adjoins, it's private, it has no public access, but it has two landowners. I believe you'd be breaking the law. Under current law, I believe those decoys can be left out overnight. But under the control, is there a way we could take out the word single? I mean, if for Representative Corn, I'm not sure if somebody's got an idea here.
Representative Corny.
I noticed the same thing. If the biggest part is if there's no public access, and that's the good part of the law, whether it's a single landowner or landowner, you could say where the land is in complete private ownership or owned exclusively, the land around the lake is exclusively private and no access. That would give everybody around the lake an opportunity to decoys out. It's up to the Representative Hackbar if he wants to make a change. But
and Madam Chair and Representative Bill, Hackbar. I think if that's okay with you, I wouldn't mind making that change if there's only a couple of landowners. I think that makes sense. But the issue is, too, that my constituents, there's not a lot of landowners on that particular lake that he's concerned about, but there is a public access. So I think this takes care of his issue, but to address the issue you're talking about, I think we could make that change. And I'd be okay with that. Should I have that ready for the next committee?
Representative McNamara.
Well, I'm sorry. Representative Hackbart, I don't know what your thoughts are, but I was just thinking if we struck the words on line 15.11, struck the word a single, and put after the word landowner, parentheses, plural, the letter F, parentheses, you know, where we had two adjoining landowners sharing a pond, they would continue, as is under current law, be able to leave their decoys out overnight. I don't know if that's a legal nightmare for the DNR.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but if we're going to hear the bill again on Wednesday night, I'd like to get it right and talk to maybe counsel or the revisor's office and just get it right. That's okay with you, Representative Bill.
That would be good. Okay. I'll make a note that we're going to fix that.
It sounds like we're probably not going to be able to solve everyone's individual concern about whether there's one or two, or I think it needs some more work.
All right, and Section 38 has to do with the possession. I'll have Mr. Bogus explain this. This is a trapping issue.
Madam Chair and members, this relates to when a person is tending traps and using a light in the field. Current law only allows them to have a 22 handgun, and the change on lines 15.19 and 15.20 would allow the same types of firearms that a person hunting raccoons with a light at night is allowed to use under current statute. So it's just a consistency provision, and it also for youth that can't use a handgun, it would allow them to check traps with a 22 rifle.
And Madam Chair, that was how this came to us, is that the youth can't have in possession a handgun, so we are adding in these calibers that are already in law, and that would then cover all people. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that youth and adults would be able to have in their possession those, either a handgun, if appropriate, or a rimfire, capable of firing those calibers. Section 39 is a very short section that is very popular, and that is the two-line Representative Junkie provision. Section 40 is the DNR again, and this has to do with the licensing of shelters and fish houses and dark houses. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Madam Chair, members, we talked about this one earlier in conjunction with the shelter.
And Section 41 allows non-residents to spear from a fish or dark house. That's the Representative Junkie. And then Section 42 removes the slot limit on, it's an Anzell bill, removes the slot limit for the size of northern pike allowed to be taken by spear. And if you'll remember the discussion about the spearing and the judging of whether the fish is in the slot or out of the slot, etc. Section 43 has to do with a slight realignment of the lake trout fishing up in the boundary waters only. It would move the opening date to January 1st in the boundary waters for lakes totally within the boundary waters, and leave the same closing date of March 31st. And except for the repealers, which is on line 18.1, and what is that repealer, Mr. Rogers?
Skip the
Oh, did I skip the mustard? IFC, you don't want to do that.
44.
Rulemaking. Yeah. Yeah. Turn the page, it's right at the top. So can you explain that repealer? We're missing, in my sheet, we're missing a page.
Yeah, there is the section 44 deals with the statewide 48-inch muskellunge by rule, except for the listed lakes in the metro area where we do we keep the 40-inch minimum size for tiger muskie, which is the muskellunge northern pike hybrid. We're moving these muskie limits from statute into rule with the good cause exemption line 17.33 to 17.35. And then the repealers.
Now, I have a question. It keeps the 40-inch size in the counties that are listed. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Bill, in the lakes that are listed in those counties,
okay,
it keeps the 40-inch minimum.
Okay.
Which are our tiger muskie lakes.
Otherwise, it will be 48-inch statewide, except for those exceptions.
That is correct, okay. Madam Chair and Representative Bill. The repealers, 97A.525 subdivision 2 is the non-resident shipping by common carrier that we combined with the resident subdivision. 97B.811 subdivision 4 is the provision related to Representative Hackbarth's bill that allows the decoys to be left out if there's no emergent vegetation sufficient to partially conceal a hunter. 97C.405 is the muskie size limit that's currently in statute that we just talked about putting into rule. And the repealer at the top of the next page deals with the effective date for the youth small game license, which we talked about earlier.
That's it, Madam Chair. And we have some things to fix. We'll be on those immediately. And if there are questions, I'll be willing to answer them. Otherwise, I'll renew my motion.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, could you go back to page 10?
Page 10?
Yeah, the bottom of page 10, line 10.31. I'm just a little uneasy with that. I know what the reason for it is. Let's say in southern Minnesota right now, if you live in Mankato, you got 2 weekends, basically, or if whatever it's changed to now, 9 days. The seasons down there generally get over the Saturday before Thanksgiving or Sunday before Thanksgiving. And then you got all that time from then on to hunt fox and coyote with a high-powered rifle because the open firearm season isn't open. What this is doing is limiting you to hunting fox or coyote with a high-powered rifle. If I'm wrong, Representative or Director Bogus, let me know. But previous to this, from the Monday before Thanksgiving until the rest of the year, you could hunt with a high-powered rifle for coyote. What this would effectively do is, while the muzzle-loading season is open the Saturday after Thanksgiving to about December 8th, you couldn't use a high-powered rifle to take coyote. You'd have to use a 22 or 17 caliber 22 mag. So I just, if that's the way I'm interpreting it, just so you know what you're voting on here, you'd be cutting out, it seems like, the predator hunters from quite a period of time here, 16 days.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gill.
Well, this is a DNR provision that came to us, and so with that, we'll have Chief Conrad explain why the department believes this is necessary.
Madam Chair, this was to resolve an issue only with the muzzleloader deer hunters who without this provision are allowed to possess not only the muzzleloader that they're hunting deer with, but a high-powered rifle as well. The problems that we were having, and this was in the northwestern part of the state, was that there were some trophy animals being taken with high-powered rifles during the muzzleloader season by people who were in possession of both types of firearms. This was to resolve that situation and allow only the use of the muzzleloaders during the muzzleloader season by those hunters to preclude them from using them illegally. It would not stop you from using that 17 caliber, which is a popular predator round, or the 22 caliber, which is the statewide exception during those times. It was not meant to prohibit anybody from hunting predators with a high-powered rifle, just those people that are hunting deer during the muzzleloader season from possessing those. If you weren't hunting muzzleloader deer, you were allowed to go shoot coyotes with any caliber that you wanted to.
Representative Cornyn.
Chief Conrad, Madam Chair, you mean that if you possessed a muzzleloader license for the last 2 weeks in November, you couldn't possess a high-powered rifle? Is that all right? Or you just can't possess it both at the same time? Or how are you reading that?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're correct. You just couldn't possess them at the same time.
I see.
While you were hunting muzzleloader, you could not possess that high-powered rifle. If you weren't muzzleloader hunting, you were allowed to go ahead and do your predator hunting with any of those high-powered rifles.
I'll let it go for now.
Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, thank you. So, Chief Conrad, did you say that if you had a muzzleloader license, but you weren't hunting and you didn't have that with you, but you and your buddies were out coyote hunting and you had a 243, you would be okay if you didn't have a muzzleloader with it after we make this change?
Chief
Conrad. Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Hearing none.
I'd like to renew my motion, Madam Chair, for 1283 DE3 as amended. Be recommended to pass and sent to Environment Policy.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be a place to
All right. Representative Dill, I believe we need to pass the amendment. I thought we had done that earlier. Anyway, apparently we need to pass the E3 amendment. So
all right,
do we
then
that
we
first, or do it as that?
Well, I have a procedural question. We voted already on the DE3 amendment as amended.
That's what I thought.
And we have not amended it any further.
For clarification. Just for clarifying, Representative Dill. Well, perhaps we did not vote on the DE3 amendment, so I would like to do that at this point. If you'd like to move that amendment, we will pass that amendment.
And then, Madam Chair, a question for the Chair, then, is that if we vote on the DE3 amendment, is that the amendment as amended, or are we going to... It would
yes,
be. All right, so my motion would be recommend to pass Environment Policy on the 1238 DE3 amendment as amended.
This is just to pass the DE3 amendment.
So then we're going to make a subsequent motion. All right. So the 1238 DE3 recommends a pass, and that's my motion.
Right. All in favor of passing the DE3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Carried.
Now, Madam Chair, I'd like to pass the same amendment, the DE3 as amended.
House Bill 1238 as amended.
Yep.
All right. All in favor of passing the House Bill 1238 as amended? Say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. Now we're done.
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.